throws. And it's hit hard to left. And that ball is gone. That new balcony, one of the fun spots in the ballpark here tonight. Somebody just got a souvenir.
Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Wednesday, April 12th. Ernie Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Ben, it is the morning after the Blue Jays home opener at a renovated Rogers Center where we, well, not we because we've been on the road with them, but where Blue Jays fans and people in Toronto finally got an up-close look at these new-look Blue Jays, these refurbished Blue Jays. They've totally overhauled the lineup. The shape of the offense is different. They're not going to just try to out-homer opponents this year anymore. They're going to have an approach. They're going to shorten up. They're going to go the other way. Defense and base running, baby. And what do they do in the opener? They get five home runs from five different players and outslug a team looking just like the Blue Jays of old.
Yeah, you'll take five home runs anytime, especially from five different players. That's a great way for the Blue Jays to start their home schedule. And I think it really was quite the event at Rogers Center. I mean, to have a full house is always fun, and it looked great. I mean, the ballpark is the same Rogers Center that Blue Jays fans have been watching baseball in for 35 years. It is one of the older facilities in baseball. That's not going to change. But there were some meaningful changes to the ballpark, and I think that's a pretty key aspect of what it means to be a Blue Jays fan, is to go down there in person. And really, to me, like, some of the things that stood out most were having fans just right at the outfield wall. Seeing it when it's empty, seeing it in the drafting drawings is so different than seeing it when it's filled with actual people. And it was cool to see fans right up against that outfield wall. There's no 10-foot gap anymore. That 10-foot gap never had any purpose. It was just there. No one benefited from it. It was no advantage to having it. And now they just have that enhanced kind of intimacy, that enhanced closeness of the fans right up against it. The bullpens right in the mix. Really cool to see that. I think the bullpens are going to be an awesome aspect of what unfolds there. So, you know, I just think that really along the outfield level, that's the biggest shift for me, observing day one of the new ballpark or the renovated ballpark.
So Rogers Center is just like gigantic, honestly, when you think about it, because you sit there and you look out at the outfield and you're like, oh, you know, it's like, yeah, they've done a lot of work, but it's, I don't know, what's that, 30% of the building, the outfield, essentially, when you think about how big the actual lower bowl is for the rest of it. So it kind of, just because of how it gets dwarfed by the size of the building, you don't really like realize the extent of the renovation, like how much work went into that. And then you start kind of like hearing about the renovation and it's like, oh, right. Like they worked, you know, for essentially like 6 months straight, like 6 days a week with 300, 400 workers on site every day, you know, working long days to, you know, what, like over 2 million pounds of concrete, and you're restoring 18,000 seats. And I mean, like 1 million pounds of steel being installed, and, you know, like 10,000 gallons of paint. Like, it's just an insane amount of work that was done out there. So you don't really even appreciate the extent of it, I think, just because of how big Rogers Center is. And then also that also makes me think of like, what is next offseason gonna be like? Because if we flash forward to December 2023 or maybe January 2024, some of this will depend on how deep into the postseason the Blue Jays go. There's gonna be a moment where you can stand like on the pitcher's mound in Rogers Center and look towards home plate, and there's going to be nothing behind it. Like that entire lower bowl, all that stuff, all those seats, entire 100 level, the clubhouses that are behind it, the facilities that are behind it, that's all going to be gone. Like, it's just going to be vacant, and the Blue Jays are going to have like a very finite amount of time to replace it with all sorts of new stuff that's going to go around the lower bowl. So it's absolutely like, it's dramatic when you look at what's happened to this point, but I don't even think that we understand how dramatic what's coming is going
to
be.
Yeah, more to come for sure. The seats in the 100 level will be replaced. There'll be some club seating down there. But even already, I mean, it's a different feel to be at the ballpark and watching this team play in a different environment. And it is a different looking team, I think, even if they did kind of revert to some of their old ways in the opener. Although, you know, reverting to your old ways, if it's hitting five home runs, like, that's good. That's the kind of regression you want to be going back to. The Jays will welcome that. And it's still a team that is doing some things in different ways. And to me, what stands out most on that front is just Kevin Kiermaier. I mean, it's quite an experience to watch Kevin Kiermaier play, I think, especially defensively. I was looking at this before we started recording. This is a guy who has a 7-WAR season, a couple 5-WAR seasons. Like, he has been an elite player in the major leagues before. And what we're seeing from him right now is absolutely elite player. It's not even just like all-star player. We're seeing elite player, impact player. Now, is he going to sustain this all season? Of course not. He's not going to hit home runs at this rate. He's not going to be driving in runs at this rate. That's fine. He might miss some time. He's 32. He's not 25 anymore. But for him to even demonstrate for an 11-game stretch that he can play at an elite level, because again, that's what this is. This is like, you know, down ballot MVP production from your number 9 hitter who's making incredible catches in the outfield, who's cutting balls off. Like, even that ball in left center field, Spencer Torkelson hits it. Kevin Kiermaier's like chasing it down, trying to get a play at second base. After the game, he was basically like crushed that he didn't get Spencer Torkelson at second base on a ball that, like, for a lot of outfielders, that might be like at the wall. They're picking it up. Torkelson's comfortably rounding second base. Like, this is the kind of play that we're seeing right now. And again, it's not going to continue at this level, but it's been pretty impressive to watch.
It's funny. I remember when the Blue Jays signed Kevin Kiermaier this offseason, I did like a deep dive at Sportsnet, and it was, I don't know what it was called, like what Kevin Kiermaier could bring to the Blue Jays. And I kind of broke it down. And the first section was defense, and the second section was base running, and then it was offense, and then it was whatever else, right? But I put, that was purposeful, that I put defense and base running like at 1 and 2, because this was the idea with Kevin Kiermaier. The Blue Jays didn't like acquire Kevin Kiermaier thinking that he was going to hit 400 or whatever he's hitting right now through 11 or 12 games. Like, I think the Blue Jays are probably very pleasantly surprised by that, but I don't think that's why they signed Kevin Kiermaier. They signed him for the overall package. And so much of that with him is like his defense and base running. And we just get in our position, like, you know, as media and elsewhere, like, we just get way too fixated on like, what's a guy's OPS? What's his batting average? Like, if you're just a DH, if you're Brandon Belt, okay, that's when you go, all right, what's your OPS? Like, how often are you walking? How often are you slugging? With a guy like Kevin Kiermaier, it's really a total package. And I think that, you know, as the Blue Jays sought to really like diversify skill sets on their roster, sought to like improve their base running, sought to improve their outfield defense, they looked at how well-rounded Kevin Kiermaier was in those areas, some of the elite skills that he clearly still has. You look at his stats this year. Do I think that his offensive production is going to maintain throughout the rest of the season? No, I do not. Do I think that his sprint speed and his outs above average is going to maintain throughout the rest of the season? Yes, I very much do. I think that he's going to continue being just that good. So I think the Blue Jays looked at the $9 million or something around there that they offered Kevin Kiermaier for 1 year, and they said, yeah, he's going to outperform this salary. Considering all around contributions, considering that WAR number that you cited, which includes the value of defense and base running, he's going to outperform the salary, you know, if he's able to be healthy coming off of hip surgery. And I think that's why they acquired him.
Well, yeah. And already he's been worth 0.7 WAR. So, you know, he's coming close to making up that contract if you go on a dollars per WAR, you know, within the first month of the season. So it's shaping up to be a great deal for the Jays, an impact deal. This is, you know, exactly what you could have hoped for. It's pretty much the best case scenario version of Kevin Kiermaier. And I think too, like, offensively, he was kind of, you know, half joking after the game on Tuesday. He said he had set a goal for himself this season to not hit any home runs, because that can kind of keep him geared toward the opposite field, making sure that he's letting the ball travel into the zone, getting a good look, not trying to get, you know, cheat on the ball and really sell out for home runs. Then all of a sudden he hits a home run. So, you know, they'll take that. But it's not just that. And obviously Tuesday was, it might be the game of the year for Kevin Kiermaier, right? Like that was, it's going to be tough to beat a home run robbery in front of a sellout crowd and hitting a home run.
Well hit ball right field. And it's gone. First as a Blue Jay for Kevin Kiermaier. And he has tied the game.
He takes one away and he gets one.
Yeah, he's plus two.
But it's not just that. And, you know, I was even reflecting back to the series in Kansas City, which you and I were both at, Arden, and there was a play in one of the games where he hits like a bleeder up the middle, like just this little ground ball, and he ends up at second base with a double. You know, this is the kind of play that should not happen in the major leagues, but it's what he's capable of doing because he is just out there looking for any advantage. And because he's healthy, because his hips are under him, he's able to take advantage of his speed and really play with a sense of abandon.
I promise you that I said on this podcast over the offseason, like just watch Kevin Kiermaier become a fan favorite within the first month of the year because he's going to turn a single into a double at some point and he's going to rob somebody of a hit in the outfield at some point. And I probably would have said like over the first month. I didn't think it was going to be over the first week. Then I was talking to Kevin before the opener, like at BP, because I was just kind of like getting some, you know, thoughts from the outfielders on the new dimensions and the walls, like how they're playing, right? Because they all went out there in the afternoon. Mark Budzinski, the Blue Jays outfield coach, went out there with his fungo and some pitching machines, like fireballs off the wall. And it was like, oh, okay, yeah, the wall's like kind of hard. And like right now the bounce is kind of dead, but maybe that'll change. And oh, hey, there's around the bullpens, we've got these new chain link fences with these stanchions. And there are like some interesting areas at the top of those chain link fences where you could get some unexpected bounces. So the Blue Jays did all that work. Then Bud like walked all the outfielders around the wall and showed them various unique angles and things to expect. So I was talking to like Farsho and Kiermaier and guys about this, and Kevin says to me, he goes like, I just hope like at some point this season I get the opportunity to like pull a ball back over that 8-foot wall in center. I just hope that opportunity comes to me at some point this year. He didn't say at some point in the first two innings of the home opener. When that happened, I was like, are you kidding me? Baseball is just, it's stranger than fiction sometimes that like something like that would just happen immediately. I don't know how you would have set odds on it, but to be like, yeah, within the first two innings of the Blue Jay season playing before these new outfield dimensions, that Kevin Kiermaier will get the opportunity to and then succeed at robbing a home run over the center field wall. It's just, it's mind-boggling that that actually happened.
As Kerry Carpenter hits one to center field, backpedaling Kiermaier, jumps, and he's got it! He took a home run away in the very first game of the season. He's going to have no trouble being popular here, Buck.
You can't make this up. Unbelievable.
Yeah, such a cool moment. Afterwards, he said he was basically on cloud nine. You could tell he was very excited, as you would expect after a play like that. This is a guy who, before the game started, he's doing pull-ups on the Blue Jays dugout. Like, he's pretty clearly excited to be a Blue Jay. It was quite a scene down there. And, you know, we're talking about the actual catch, of course, as we should, but you know, there are a couple things in that outfield on Tuesday that I did notice. And on that play where Kiermaier's going back to make that catch against Carpenter, it's really interesting. When you watch the replay, you see Dalton Varsho sprinting over to center field just in case that ball had rattled away from Kiermaier, Varsho would have been there. And then later, Kiermaier, I think it was that same inning with Manoah struggling, there was a home run hit to right field. Springer's up against the wall. Kiermaier, meanwhile, with the high wall now in right field, the 12 to 14 foot wall, Kiermaier is sprinting over into right field. And look, this is what they should be doing. They're major league players. This is like their job to hustle and to back up. So I'm not saying it's like that remarkable, but at the same time, didn't see that every day last year. And that's nothing against Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who are good baseball players and are going to help major league teams win games this year. But it's a different style of play, and it's just worth noting that Varsho, Kiermaier, Springer, these guys are on it early this season.
Well, and that's part of what Bud went over with them before the game was like, we need to be like on our backups here in the outfield, because you can get some unexpected bounces that will for like Springer in right field with that like bullpen that juts in, it's 359 in the power alley to right center. You might get a bounce that goes back into center field, right? And could, so like Springer, like if for he can kind of play it square and try to read it, but it might bounce like laterally, unexpectedly in a direction that he is not moving towards. And then he has to get moving and accelerate in that direction. So that's why you're going to see on balls to right and left, Kevin Kiermaier sprinting in either direction. And honestly, it's like, it's Kevin Kiermaier. He'd do this anyway. I think this is for that story I did on him. And I don't think I ended up using it, but I remember I pulled up all this like fizz, all these clips of him nearly like running over his corner outfielders with Tampa, because this, he thinks he can catch everything from foul line to foul line. Like he honestly does. So he just chases everything with its serious intent. But yeah, that's going to be more important now at Rogers Center with the those like juts at the bullpens coming in, because you might get some balls that bounce laterally in a way that you're not expecting. So that is like one of the things that Blue Jays went over before the game, that and also the point that like the walls are hard, the old walls had some give. So Dalton Varsho was telling me like, yeah, I need to be cognizant of the fact like I can't run into that wall at full speed because I'm going to knock myself out. That wall is really hard there. So that was part of the sort of the reconnaissance that Mark Budzinski was relaying to his outfield just before the game.
And it's interesting, you know, talking to people around the Jays and then also asking AJ Hinch about this before the game, there's a sense that it'll probably take a couple days for these outfielders to get comfortable with it. Probably not longer than that, which is interesting. I mean, it's one of those things where, yep, it's new right now. It's an adjustment right now. Eventually, it'll become a slight advantage to the Jays as new teams come in and they're familiar with it. But these are great athletes and they adjust quickly. And so that advantage will probably last like a day or two max.
Do you want to make any like grand overreactions to how the ballpark is playing off of the one game that we've seen with balls in play being hit towards that outfield?
I do think we're going to see a lot of homers. I think it's going to be a homer-friendly park. And it already was, and I think that's probably going to be more so the case in 2023 and beyond. What about you?
Honestly, the only one that stands out to me from the opener was the Bichette one to right center. Yeah. And Bo looked like he was targeting that all night with his swings. Look, he got one, right? But that one, I'm like, maybe it goes off the wall last year. I don't know that it's caught. I'm fairly certain that it's not a homer last year at the Rogers Center, and like it's probably one of those that was like, it's probably a homer at Yankee Stadium and like, you know, Great American Ballpark or whatever, but I bet you that at the majority of MLB parks, that's not a home run.
Swings at the first pitch and drives it out to deep right field. Hurling at the wall, it's gone! Bo Bichette starts the eighth with his fourth home run of the season.
But that's the only one from the opener that stands out to me as like a quote-unquote Rogers Center homer. I thought the rest of them were pretty true homers, like balls that were crushed and going to be out anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it plays. It's obviously early, but it's a cozy setup. And maybe some of that is the seats, right? Where, you know, you don't have that gap. It just, everything is kind of drawn in, which is great, again, from a fan experience. I think also just viewing it, whether you're there in person or watching on TV, I think it looks better. Who needs a 10-foot gap between the wall? And it's something, it's kind of funny because like I literally never thought about that. In all the years I've watched games at Rogers Center, it never even occurred to me that there was a gap between the fence and the seats. And then you kind of realize when they close it, it's like, oh yeah, they should have closed that years ago, but better now than later.
I mean, that was so that they could make it a football field, right? Like, because they would rotate things. And so, like, that's why they had that. And so, also for concerts and things like that, it was more of a multi-purpose facility, which made sense in the late 80s and early 90s. That's what people wanted. But it's 2023 now, and it's a ballpark, and people want a ballpark. And it is becoming that. It's about 30% ballpark now. And after next winter, it should be close to 100% ballpark. The thing I would caution against is just like reading anything into the balls that we see in play right now and saying, oh, this is going to be a homer happy place. Oh, offense is going to be this, or it's going to be that. Like, honestly, like just from actually talking to people who have done this work with modeling and with kind of trying to project how it's going to play, you need 2 to 3 years of balls in play to actually feel confident in saying, okay, the ballpark plays this way. Until you have, like, that's the sample that you need. That's the amount of data, not just one game. And honestly, not even just 81. Honestly, not even 81 games. We're talking 3 seasons worth of data before, like, people who actually do this for a living will be like, okay, I can say with some certainty that Rogers Center plays this way. Because, like, the Blue Jays have done, like, this work. The dimensions of the walls, the heights, the angles, like, that's all, that's not a mistake. Like, that's all purposeful, right? Because that's because, like, the Blue Jays took batted ball distributions and overlaid them on different dimensions and different heights and things like that. But it's so hard to account for a lot of the other sort of factors there when you think about, well, roof open versus roof closed, and then what's the wind with, you know, various months, and when, you know, the roof's open during the day and during the night, what's the air temperature, how does that affect it, you know, how the amount of foul ground, right? Like, how many, what's that going to mean, you know, like the netting, right? The netting is higher now in various parts, and a ball hits a net and it's dead automatically. Like, all that stuff factors into it, and a lot of that stuff is really hard to account for in a model on a computer, just until you just get balls flying in the real world and actually see how it happens. So I think the Blue Jays feel they've done the best job possible to make it neutral to what it was in the past. But ultimately, I mean, you're working with a pretty imperfect system for doing that. So, like, I think, you know, I think you're ultimately, like, absolutely, there's going to be doubles that are now going to be homers. I think there might be homers that now become doubles. So maybe that kind of counterbalances. But ultimately, like, we just are not going to know for years, for like 3 years, how this ballpark truly plays. So I would say just be careful about, you know, anyone who's saying this ballpark is this today.
Yeah, of course, there's no substitute for data. We need more information there. But absent that information, if I had to guess, I'm going to guess that it's going to be Homer happy place. But yes, that is a guess at this point.
Well, the other thing I have come to understand is that, like, size of outfield is a massive factor as well. And so this is a smaller outfield to patrol. And the Blue Jays outfield defenders, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, have gone a lot better. So I think the Blue Jays are actually legitimately going to have a very high outs above average defensively this year, because, like, there's, you know, Kevin Kiermaier and George Springer and Dalton Varsho are just patrolling less ground. Like, that's part of the Coors Field effect, honestly, is that, like, the outfield is huge, man. In Kansas City, you were there, that outfield is massive. It's so big. So, like, at a certain point, like, you could push the walls back to 500 feet, but then you're just creating more ground for your outfielders to cover, and they just can't, like, actually feasibly cover that much. So you're gonna have all kinds of doubles and triples falling in, right? So I that's part of why I think, like, outfield, like, size of outfield is really meaningful in how a ballpark plays and how a team does defensively from an outfield standpoint. It's kind of related to how, like, when you order some of the best outfield defenders in MLB year over year, it's almost always the speediest guys, because speed is huge in outfield defense. Like, it really does correlate really strongly. And hey, man, what are we seeing from Kevin Kiermaier this year? Absolutely elite, like 95th percentile sprint speed. It adds up.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to have that that speed. Kiermaier right now has the health to cover that ground. Varsho, young, fast, he can cover that ground. Springer giving you some good reads in right field, making good decisions, throwing better. It's a very, very strong defensive outfield.
The Blue Jays sprint speed leaders so far through 11 games. Number one, Kevin Kiermaier. Number two, Whit Merrifield. Number three, George Springer. Varsho's at 5. So, like, Kiermaier, Springer, Varsho in your top 5, like, that's one point on that. It's huge to have your 3 outfielders, like, being some of your fastest players on the team. Point number two on that, number 1, 2, 3, Kiermaier, Merrifield, and Springer. To the point that we were making a few podcasts ago, Blue Jays lead league in fast veterans. Those guys are all, like, 33, 34. You know, Matt Chapman's up there on the list as well, and we should talk about Chapman too. That's a guy who's, like, going to turn 30 later this month. Blue Jays lead the league in those speedy veterans.
Yeah, Chapman's been great. I mean, he's been such a difference maker for this team. Maybe this is one of those walk years that we've seen from guys like Marcus Semien and Robbie Ray here in Toronto. Certainly setting up to be that way so far. He was one of those five home runs on opening day. Continues to hit. Obviously, we know about the defense. And again, this is not going to be sustained to the level that he's shown so far this season, but doesn't have to be. He can hit 260 and still put up a 5 or 6 WAR season, still end up on MVP ballots. Like, this is really impressive. It's a sign that some of those swing changes that he made and didn't look entirely comfortable at all times in spring training. He was still working through some things as he made some adjustments there with his stride, but it's working. It's working really well right now, and the Jays have to be thrilled with what they're getting from Chapman.
It's another reminder about spring stats. There's probably no shortage of people at the end of spring training who are saying, man, Matt Chapman looks lost. Like, what's going on? He's in his head. The swing changes aren't taking. And then literally from game one, he's been raking.
You know, it's so interesting, though, because, and yeah, that's a great point. But, you know, some of the guys on the Jays roster who didn't get a lot of reps in spring, whether it's Alejandro Kirk, whether it's Brandon Belt, they actually are starting off pretty slowly. And to me, it's like, at least Chapman was in there. At least he was getting those reps. Kirk, you know, he's been slowly kind of showing signs of coming around in all phases of his game. Belt as well had a 3-hit game in the opener on Tuesday. That was a much needed sign for the Blue Jays. Even Chris Bassett, you know, as he was working through some things in spring, and that has continued to be an adjustment period for him, which we'll get to that later. But with Belt in particular, I do think that the lack of at-bats that he had in spring are really showing themselves now. And of course, he's 34 years old. You're not going to tell him you need to have 70 spring at-bats and we're going to make this call for you. You're not going to dictate terms on a veteran who you're signing to a $9.3 million deal. You obviously have some trust in his knowledge of himself. But in hindsight, he probably did need more at-bats because he wasn't ready to start this year. That's pretty clear.
So let's say this, you want to look at spring process rather than results, right? Because like, yeah, the process with Belt right now is that like he is swinging and missing a lot in the zone, outside the zone as well. But like the swing and miss, like that's not good. That's not what you want to see going forward. It was interesting to see the opposite field hits for Belt in the home opener. I'm not smart enough to tell you if that just means that A, he's trying to do that, or like B, his bat's coming around. And so like maybe like that's why the balls were going to the opposite field. Like you're going to see defensive alignments against Belt all year long where the outfielders are shaded to the right and that shortstop is like as close to second base as he possibly can be with the new shift restrictions, because historically like that's how Brandon Belt has batted the ball, and he will historically play to those. He should play to those tendencies going forward. But I think that also gets to the point about Belt where it's like you have a substantial track record here of this guy like being good and having a good process and having a good approach and that working for him. So I think he's earned a bit more runway than for us to just like write him off after a rough first 6 or 7 games.
For sure. For sure. And, you know, I think that in spring, it was the right call to let him guide that process because he's the one who's able to answer questions about what kind of timing he needs and where his pain is at as he recovers from a knee operation, says he's feeling good. You're going to trust him at that point. You brought him in here with the understanding that he was going to be an important voice in that. He's not 21 years old, although hopefully they'd listen to a 21-year-old as well. But what I'm saying is, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, clearly, like he's striking out multiple times every single game until Tuesday. These were not major league caliber at-bats. He was striking out 60% of the time. Knowing what we know now, those at-bats should have been taking place in the Grapefruit League. They should have been taking place, maybe he should have started the season on the IL, knowing what we know now, because it was not competitive. But at the same time, you got to give him a chance to work it through. And this is where, you know, as the Jays were facing the Angels this weekend, you have 3 left-handed starting pitchers. Of course, you know, that's not ideal. You kind of want Brandon Belt to be able to get in there against some righties, get some timing, shorten up his swing. He told Shai Davide after the game on Tuesday that he was deliberately trying to just be a bit shorter to the ball, try to make some more contact, and obviously it worked with that 3-hit game. So this is a good hitter. We don't want to forget that it was as recent as 2021 that he hit 29 home runs in about 100 games. That's an incredibly impressive offensive display. So you're not going to be in a rush to write him off, especially with a $9.3 million investment. But they needed to see some signs of life, because there's only so long when you're trying to compete every game against the best teams in the league. Well, not the Tigers, but the Rays are coming to town. And I think you need to find ways to produce as much as possible. So you don't want to send a guy out there who's not feeling it offensively. Clearly Belt wasn't, but maybe this is a sign that he can get things going.
That swing note is interesting, because maybe that explains the two opposite field hits that we saw in the opener. The big things for me are just like the chase rate for him, like, needs to come down. And over the course of his career, he's been a guy who's very stubbornly hasn't chased. So I think you can have some confidence in that happening. And then just doing damage on good pitches to hit in the zone. It's like not doing damage on those pitches on the plate that you're working to get to so that you can drive them. That needs to come around, and maybe some of the swing stuff and just, yeah, some of the reps that he clearly needs will help with that. The guy whose process I have zero concerns with is Matt Chapman, who, like, yeah, is leading the league in every offensive category you can imagine, and the results are amazing. But you look at how he's getting to those results, not just like balls are falling in or he's finding gaps, or it's like this guy is driving everything.
1-1, slugged out to right center field, hit pretty well, Green's at the wall, it's gone! The red hot ride with Matt Chapman rolls on, his third home run of the season.
Leads baseball in barrels, leads it in barrels per plate appearances, leads baseball in hard hit rate, second in baseball in balls hit 95 miles per hour or harder off of his bat. And he is only second because Vlad is first. The process stuff for Matt Chapman is so, so encouraging. Like, it tells you that, like, mechanically, like, everything is sound for him. He's seeing pitches really well. Like, he must be so confident in the box right now. That toe tap that he added, I mean, part of that was the Matt Chapman wanted to use the whole field. Like, he felt like he got really pull happy in 22, and you can go back earlier in his career, and he is much more of an all field hitter. And you look at the results so far of that, like, quest to use the whole field more often, and it seems to be paying off. Like, Matt Chapman, to this point in the year, like, he already has four opposite field hits. He had only 18 last year, Ben. All of last season, he had only 18, and this is an everyday player. He has four already this year. Like, it took him 18 plate appearances to get those four this year. It took him like 50 to get to four last year. So those signs are beyond, like, obviously the results, which are great. Those process indicators for Matt Chapman, super, super encouraging.
Yeah, I'm sure when the Jays are looking at the hard hit leaderboards of the players in baseball who are making the best contact, and they see Vlad and Chapman and Bo at the very top of those lists, that's got to be so encouraging. And, you know, as for Chapman, they need some players who are going to have career years, right? If you're going to win this division, which should still be the goal, even if the Rays are undefeated, and finding, you know, ace pitchers out of nowhere like Jeffrey Springs and Drew Rasmussen, you're going to need some career years as well. You know, you can't just beat the Rays and the Yankees with them having, you know, these career years and you not. You need to have some players step up. And maybe Chapman's going to be one of those players for the Jays. They will need some of those guys. And Chapman is certainly capable of that.
The amazing thing about Chapman as well, before we take a break here, I can actually make a case for you that he's been unlucky this year. Matt Chapman leads MLB in barreled balls that didn't result in home runs. He's barreled 9 balls that haven't left the park to this point. He's hit 3 balls 400 plus feet that didn't leave the yard, Ben.
Wow.
And 2 of them were outs. He's hit 2 403-foot outs this year. I mean, there have been only 36 balls hit 400 feet or further that didn't produce a home run across MLB this season. Matt Chapman has 3 of them. It's like he has nearly 10% of those events. So if anything, wow, he's actually been a little bit unlucky.
Yeah, that's wild. It reminds me of Carpenter with the Tigers, who hit about 799 feet of fly ball outs to Kevin Kiermaier the other day. You're just kind of thinking, man, for the Tigers team that has like very, very little going right for it, that's pretty rough. But yeah, for Chapman, good news. And I'm sure the Jays can reasonably expect that more of those balls will fall in as they move ahead.
We should step away and take a break, but when we come back, I have some things I want to say about Dalton Varsho, and then we should also recap just what the hell is going on with this starting rotation, which has been the weird Achilles heel for the Blue Jays. All that and so much more when we continue on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson, Smith. Thanks as always to our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. And thanks as always to you for listening. You can send us an email. It's attheletters@sportsnet.ca. Ben, early impressions of Dalton Varsho, because we covered off the other two new guys in Belton and Kiermaier in the first half, and we're going to get Chris Bassitt a bit later, but early impressions of how Dalton Varsho's impact in the 2023 Toronto Blue Jays.
I think he's been great. I think that at this point, the Jays are 2 for 3 with their additions of position players, those lefty bats that they added. Belt, obviously a whiff at this point, and clearly Kevin Kiermaier has been a great addition, and I think Dalton Varsho belongs in that category. He has looked like an impact player when he's hitting. We're seeing him put the ball in the air. We're seeing him make really good contact consistently. We're seeing him drop down a few bunts here and there. Great base runner, someone who's got seemingly really good instincts on the base paths and in the outfield, where he's just cutting off balls, getting to balls in the corner. I haven't seen, I don't think, any balls like rattling around left field while opponents circle the bases. Varsho, to me, looks like an all-star. He looks like someone that you want on your team for years to come. And that's what the Blue Jays wanted. They certainly paid a high price to get him, because Gabriel Moreno is also a very, very good player. But this has the makings of a win-win trade, one where Arizona benefits and the Blue Jays, I think, are very happy with Dalton Varsho, and I think they should be, because he's been tremendous so far.
With all the normal caveats, right? Week and a half into the season, it's small sample theater, it is what it is. I am adjusting my expectations upwards on Dalton Varsho, and I am like, I have to do a mea culpa. I was low on Dalton Varsho, and I was wrong coming into the season. And what I missed was that this is a player who's still developing. And this is a player who's still getting better. Like, this guy's 26,
yeah,
right? Like, that's 2 years younger than Kevin Biggio, Santiago Espinal, and Danny Jansen. The Blue Jays, as I mentioned in the first half, acquired Kevin Kiermaier because they believed he would raise the bar for outfield defense and he would bring a lot of, you know, base running. Like, they acquired Dalton Varsho because the Blue Jays think that he's a really good all-around player who is still on the upswing and still getting better and actually has a much higher ceiling to reach over the 4 years of which they have club control over him remaining. And I think that we are already seeing that development happen this year. Like, we're already seeing Dalton Varsho unlock some of that previously untapped potential. He hit his first opposite field home run last week against Kansas City Royals since 2021.
Blue Jays leading 2-1, and Varsho sends one in the air, fairly well hit, to the opposite field, and it's gone. Dalton Varsho's first home run as a Blue Jay, and it is now 3-1.
This is a guy who had 27 bombs last year, so went over the wall in the opposite field for the first time in years. He set a new career high in max exit velocity on opening day. He's put 25 balls in play this year, and four of them rank within the top 35 hardest hit balls of his career. So that is four balls in play this year that are within the 95th percentile for his career. We're talking about like a career sample of nearly 700 balls in play. We're seeing different things from him that you haven't seen that much before. And that can be extended to the performance against left-handed pitching as well. Like, Dalton Varsho came into this year saying, in 2022, I got pull happy. I was only looking for like that ball inside from lefties that I could turn on. I wasn't staying with that pitch away and like trusting my hands and my bat speed that I can keep that pitch fair and like live off some of those singles and doubles to left field. And now like you're seeing like such a better approach against lefties. I already mentioned that opposite field homer that he hit, the first since 2021. That's a massive sign for him. We've already seen this year two walks against left-handed pitchers. He's got two walks and 16 plate appearances against left-handed pitching this year. You know how many walks Dalton Varsho had against left-handed pitching last year? He had three in 129 plate appearances. He's already got two and 16. Like, I cannot like state enough like how massive some of these indications are for Dalton Varsho continuing to develop. And I go back to a plate appearance he had against Tyler Anderson in the Angels series. The Angels threw three lefties at the Blue Jays, and Varsho was in there for two of those games. And I remember Anderson got Varsho out with cutters in each of his first two plate appearances. And then Dalton Varsho made the adjustment in the third plate appearance. He chased another cutter and he made the adjustment. And I know he did because I talked to him about it and he told me the adjustment that he made. And it's just remarkable that he was able to do that like within a game, within a plate appearance. And then he laid off the next cutter and laid off another really tough sinker. Like with Anderson, it's really tough for a left-handed hitter to differentiate between his sinker and his cutter. They look very similar out of his hand. And Varsho made an adjustment to them, laid off some really tough pitches just off the plate, drew one of those walks against left-handed pitching and actually knocked Anderson out of a game with that walk. So I just think that like for all those reasons and more, Dalton Varsho has been very impressive this year. And I think the Blue Jays have a player who is really blossoming and coming into his own and is only going to continue to get better.
Well, it would be huge if he can continue that progress against left-handed pitching, because this is clearly a question for the Jays, is what do they do when with their outfield on days that you're facing a left-handed starter. And clearly Kiermaier or Varsho or both will have to be in there. And Kiermaier right now, you want his glove in there. You're happy to, you know, take a bit of a hit offensively. But there could come a time where his back cools down. Maybe he's a guy who goes to the bench. Varsho slides to center field. Maybe you're playing Whit Merrifield in the corner at that point. But then if Varsho is giving you some real production left on left, you feel more comfortable with that. And I think it's a good point. You know, his youth is there, 26 years old. This is an age where guys take strides. They've had some experience in the major leagues. Varsho certainly has. And if he can build on that to the point that he's maybe an average hitter or even slightly below against lefties, but you're comfortable having him in there, that would be a nice stride forward for the Jays.
He's just such a smart, heady ball player. I know this kind of strays into like the soft science part of it, not really territory that you and I often tread, but like he is just his reads in the outfield are tremendous. When he threw out I forget who he threw out at the plate in the Royals series, but you look at just the way he positioned himself behind that ball in left field, just how just like smart and cerebral he was with the way that he approached that, the little curl that he took at the end just to get everything that he possibly could behind that throw. It was the second hardest throw of his career. By the way, Dalton Varsho, not a huge throwing arm, but like positioned himself so well on that play, honestly, just to get everything behind it and throw out a base runner at home and take a run off the board. Again, like run prevention matters. Like a run prevented is just as valuable as a run produced. You're seeing Varsho do that. Smart with the bunt decisions too, as you mentioned, right? Like those drag bunts to the first base side. Nobody does it more than Dalton Varsho in this game. He's 16 of 17 since 2021. Part of that is his speed. He's super fast home to first, so like that helps him certainly, but part of that is just the moments he chooses to do it. And I look back to the one against Detmers in the Angels series where Matt Chapman just hit a grand slam, the place is going nuts, Detmers on the mound is like gotta be feeling it, where he's like, oh geez, I just gave up like four runs with one swing, oh god, what's going on here? You know, they're still showing replays of the Chapman grand slam, and Varsho immediately first pitch, bang, drop down the bunt. What a perfect spot for it. Like, what a perfect moment to do that. Executes it, and then Detmers is out of the game Again, Varsho knocks a starter out of the game with a heady, intelligent play like that bunt, just like the walk against Anderson, which drove him from a game. I just think that little things like that are actually really, really big things.
Well, I have a theory that it's easier to be a heady, intelligent player when you have the athleticism and the health, of course, that Varsho has, because he moves around so well, he's able to get himself in good positions. I mean, you could be, you know, let's say Alejandro Kirk or Brandon Belt, someone who doesn't have the foot speed of a Dalton Varsho, you might know in your head that this is a great time to drop down a bunt. But if you're not confident that you can beat it down the line, you're probably not going to do it. And so Varsho has the awareness, has the baseball IQ to make those calls, and he has the athleticism to back them up and to put himself into those positions and execute. So it's really a great combination. I think it's a welcome addition to the Blue Jays to have players who can do that. They've certainly got a bunch of them. You know, George Springer makes some really good decisions out there. You know, you've obviously got a guy like Kevin Biggio, who's regarded as a great base runner. And so all those things can add up. Kevin Kiermaier in that discussion, of course. But you need those. It's a long season. You're playing a lot of really close games. Sometimes you'll hit five home runs, but sometimes you won't. And a play like that can make the difference between a win and a loss.
It has been a much more aesthetically pleasing brand of baseball to watch from the Toronto Blue Jays. I'll say that. The only place where that has not been true, honestly, is in the starting pitching. Aside from Kevin Gausman, you know, not a lot to like about the way the Blue Jays starters have been performing to this point. I'll let you take your pick, man. Would you like to dive in on Alek Manoah, who looked really rough in the home opener? Would you like to go back to Chris Bassitt, who's continuing to have, you know, figure things out with his mechanics and his velo? Or do you want to look at, you know, Jose Berríos and Yusei Kikuchi?
A lot to choose from, which is not where the Blue Jays want to be, right? They want to just have everything cruising along. And really, Gausman, as we record this, he's about to start on Wednesday. But as we record this, he's had two great starts, and that's where you want to be. I think it's interesting to start almost with Gausman in relation to Bassitt, because there is a contrast there. Kevin Gausman also had to make a lot of adjustments in spring training with respect to the pitch timer, what it would mean for him to start his delivery with his rocking back and forth on the mound. Going into spring, if you had asked us, Arden, I would guess that we probably would have pegged Kevin Gausman and Chris Bassitt as probably the two guys who would have the biggest adjustments to make with respect to adapting to the pitch clock. I certainly would have pointed to those guys.
I would have thrown Manoah in there just because he was one of the slowest workers last year. So I would have thrown Manoah in there as well.
And he has been making some adjustments. It's interesting too, just as a quick note, how in Kansas City he was throwing the ball out of play to buy himself some time. At least that's me saying that. Alek Manoah said that he just was not liking the balls. So let's note that that was what he said. But I think that in a broad sense, at least, that's going to be a tactic that some pitchers use to get themselves a few more seconds. I don't like this ball. Restart the clock. Get a new ball. But back to Bassitt and Gausman. You look at Gausman, he's been able to make those adjustments really well. Bassitt has not so far. And that's by his own admission. He's searching for his mechanics. He's been having issues with the PitchCom technology. He's been trying to get on the same page as his catchers, Jansen and then Kirk. It really has been a challenge for him. The mechanical issues, from what he said publicly, have contributed to a drop in velocity, which is really not good, because it's not like he was working with 96 to begin with. He's down about a mile and a half on his fastballs. And so it adds up to a pretty messy two starts for Bassitt, and he's kind of discombobulated from what we've seen so far. Now, his second start was better, but again, in contrast to Gausman, he has not been able to make those adjustments. It's just been a longer adjustment period, and it makes sense. He has 7 or 8 pitches on any given night. There's a lot going on. He's had some technological mishaps with the PitchCom devices. It's been a challenge for him, but the Jays really do need him to figure this out, and ideally it would have happened in spring training. Now here they are, is what it is, but he's a really important pitcher to this staff, and they need him to get it sorted.
I'm not a golfer. I don't know how many mulligans you get in golf, but I'm willing to give Chris Bassitt another one. I know I gave him one for the opener in St. Louis, because, like, as you said, velo was down, execution was poor, and St. Louis just had a phenomenal game plan against them, and yeah, they were super aggressive again in that mulligan. I'm giving them another one for LA just because of everything that was going on in Anaheim. Like, start with this. Danny Jansen was supposed to catch that game, and then Danny Jansen came down with like a really bad stomach bug. So Alejandro Kirk finds out, like, day of the game, you're in there. Like, you're catching him. And Bassett threw to Kirk once in spring training.
Yeah, not much at all. He was working closely with Jansen in spring.
Exactly. Not a lot of familiarity there. They hadn't been working together all week, right? Like, Kirk hadn't been catching his bullpens. Kirk has no idea what Chris Bassett wants to do on the mound. Like, they haven't got, you know, they had their pregame meeting, and that's it. It's just not enough for any pitcher in baseball, but particularly one who throws eight pitches and is as fastidious as Chris Bassett is. So already, like, behind the eight ball there. Now you need the pitch calm. Like, Chris Bassett in that outing now needs to call his own game because, like, the catcher has no clue what he wants to throw. And then Chris Bassett gets out there onto the mound and finds out that his device is actually programmed to another pitcher on the Blue Jays staff. And Chris Bassett will own it and say, like, that's my fault. He accidentally changed the programming of the device when he was affixing it to his belt because he saw that Greinke was using it on his belt, KC, and Bassett was like, oh, like, I kind of want to use it on my belt as well rather than my glove. And while he was affixing it to his belt, he kind of like accidentally pressed whatever the sequence of buttons is that changes the device's mode to another pitcher's programming. So then Bassett goes to press like the two-seamer button and it says curveball. And he goes to press the sweeper button and it says four-seamer. Like, it was saying pitches that Chris Bassett doesn't even throw. And Chris Bassett throws a ton of pitches. So that's what's happening. And that's happening in real time on the mound while you're being like charged for automatic balls. Leadoff hitter is walked. And oh, by the way, here comes the best hitter on the planet in Mike Trout. Try executing to the best hitter on the planet when everything's going your way. It's hard. But when everything's spiraling on you, it's even harder. Mike Trout took Chris Bassett deep. Bassett took ownership for this after the game, for the mistakes and for the way that things went for him. But from after that Trout plate appearance on, once they got the pitch calm sorted, once like he had kind of explained a little bit to Alejandro Kirk what the process was going to be going forward, he was kind of Chris Bassett from that point forward, throwing eight different pitches. Swinging strikes was six different pitches. I forget the total number of swinging strikes, but I believe it might have been close to double digits, if not into double digits. Tons of weak contact, more walks than you'd like, but also like a strike zone that wasn't perfectly adjudicated that day. I thought Chris Bassett looked like Chris Bassett after the Mike Trout plate appearance. And I would expect him to look more like himself going forward, given the extensive track record. Once he sorts out some of these mechanical things and gets more over his back leg and stays kind of more coiled and is more directional towards the plate, I am willing to give him mulligans for both those two outings just because of some of the exceptional circumstances that he's dealing with.
Yeah, the circumstances were definitely contributing. I think, and he did take ownership of this, as you say, but I think in some cases those were products of his own creation. You know, it's kind of like if I got locked out of my work email and I couldn't find my passwords and I missed some important meetings or whatever the case. I mean, I think, you know, there's room to say, okay, we'll get him next time. Like, let's move on. But end of the day, like, I am responsible for those things. Just as Chris Bassett is responsible for making sure that the pitch comm is there and that his mechanics are in line. So I do think, though, that I would expect a bounce back. I would expect that these starts are not representative of who he is. And I think that he's probably going to be more like the pitcher that the Blue Jays expected to be signing, because there is a lot going on. There are a lot of moving parts. So I think that the velocity, though, is an interesting question, because at a certain point, and it's not now, I think that Chris Bassett does deserve some patience here, but at a certain point, you really would want to see him throwing harder if you're the Toronto Blue Jays. A drop-off in velo for two starts, I agree. There are a lot of mitigating factors. You know, you're not gonna assume that velo is never coming back. But if it gets to four starts and the velo is down, you're probably looking at a drop in velocity, and that's really not good. So I think the next couple starts, I'll be watching closely to see what that radar gun looks like, to see how comfortable he is with his mechanics, how much comfort he can get with pitch calm, because at a certain point, he's got to figure that stuff out. That's part of the challenge of being a major league pitcher in this day and age, is working within the restrictions of the pitch calm devices and the pitch clock. And it's especially important for Bassett. So figuring that out is really crucial for him.
That's absolutely fair with regards to the velocity. And the one thing you can look back at is like early in 2022 in April, like the velo wasn't quite there as well. And it came as the season went on. So, you know, there's at least a little bit of precedent there that, you know, you can kind of trust what he's telling us and see if that's going to progress. And I think the encouraging thing is that once he got past the first few batters, really the first inning against the Angels, where he had someone who doesn't know how to call his game being forced to call his game. Once he got past that and they got the pitch calm sorted out, Chris Bassett was able to be effective without peak velocity, right? Like he was still able to get a ton of swing and miss and a ton of weak contact without that primo stuff. So I think that's encouraging for him going forward, if even over the final few starts of this month, he's still like 91, 92.
Yeah. And Greinke is a great comp for him. I mean, that's kind of where the trajectory is probably going for Chris Bassett. But you'd probably rather that happens in year three of the contract, where he's throwing 90, 91, as opposed to year one of the contract. And, you know, I asked around a little bit, some executives with different teams, like at what point do you start getting worried or start reading into velocity? And they said, actually, it's pretty early. It's earlier than you might think that it becomes very predictive of what is to come in that season. So within, you know, a few weeks, if you see a drop off in velocity, that is very predictive of what is to come for the rest of the year. That does not mean that's the case for every pitcher. That does not mean that there won't be exceptions. But generally speaking, if after a few weeks a pitcher's velocity is down, that means that is likely what's going to continue.
Well, then what do you make, good sir, of the fact that Alek Manoah in 2021 and 2022 was a 93, 94 mile per hour fastball guy, and in the Blue Jays home opener and the outing preceding it, not opening day, by the way, opening day, Manoah was like 93, 94, but in his last two outings since, Manoah's been like 91, 92. What do you make of that?
I'd put it in a similar category where I would say not good, not what you want to see. And yet Manoah, like Bassett, has earned a lot of benefit of the doubt. I don't think anyone should be panicking here, but it's something to monitor. And in listening to him speak to the media after his start in the opener, he was clearly frustrated with his mechanics, and he was saying he was searching for it mechanically. He said he was sometimes too much in mechanics mode on the mound, not enough in attack mode, not enough in compete mode. This is a challenge we've heard a few pitchers talk about this year. For some, it's worked really well, like Kikuchi. For Manoah, at least on Tuesday, he felt like there was a bit too much thinking through the mechanics, and he wasn't quite where he wanted to be in the flow of competing and the flow of really executing out there. And lo and behold, the results velocity wise were not there. So for me, I don't know if you differ on this, but for me, I look at it and I say, it's not good. It's not what you want to see. It's also not the end of the world. It's something to monitor as they move ahead.
It's been a little bit of whack-a-mole with Manoah, honestly, because on opening day, like true opening day in St. Louis, the velo was there, but his slider was not good. Like his slider got hit against the Cardinals. And then the second outing of the year, slider was much better, a lot more effective, but the velo wasn't there. And then in the home opener at Rogers Center, velo wasn't there. And I mean, the slider, like the stuff was okay. Manoah just could not command it. Like he was missing so consistently early with his slider extension side. So like, by which I mean like, you know, away from a righty and back foot to a lefty. Like he was just missing by so much that Tigers hitters just like were laying off of spin and just sitting on fastballs. And when those fastballs are 91, 92, you know, Nick Maton ends up like parking one, right? Like that's, and I thought the patience and selectivity from the Tigers was great as well in drawing as many walks as they did against Manoah, because he was leaving a lot of fastballs up in hittable locations. I would have understood if the Tigers were starting to get aggressive against those pitches, but they really like worked an approach and took their walks and were like this close to like blowing that thing wide open. It's a credit to Manoah that he actually only allowed three runs a night when he pitched, honestly, like pretty poorly. But yeah, you could see him fighting his mechanics on the mound, honestly, with that slider. Like you could see him doing different things mechanically. And he's one of the better guys in baseball at making in-game adjustments and reading swings and reacting to what's happening in a game and making little adjustments. I think he just had a hard time on Tuesday, like finding it. And then, as you mentioned, like got too into adjustment mode rather than just like, all right, what do I have that's working? And let's use that. Let's compete. Let's battle. Let's find a way to maximize what is actually working for me today instead of trying to like regain the stuff that isn't. So it's interesting because each time out for him, it's just kind of been something a little different that has been off. And I can't really put my finger on exactly what's going on. I just know that, you know, his side session is going to be pretty involved when he throws it between, you know, the home opener start and his next one.
Well, yeah, give him credit for staying in that game and competing and finding ways to continue to get outs, even when he did not have his best stuff, when he did not have his mechanics. I think it's also interesting. Manoah is someone that we've really only seen good. Like he's been so consistently good as a major league pitcher, Cy Young finalist in his first season. And I do think that he's entitled to work through some things and to develop on the go as still a young pitcher who's 25 years old and really shot through the upper minors of the Jays system, shot through the minors period of the Jays system. And so if he runs into some struggles and has to work some things out in the majors, I think he's entitled to that. Now, you'd much rather he's doing that with 93, 94 than 91, 92. So that's worth monitoring. And it would be a lot easier if, you know, guys like Kikuchi and Berríos were giving a bit more consistency in the rotation to go along with Gausman.
It's just it's a weird time of year with velocity because like even Kevin Gausman's fastball velocity has been down and like was down in his second outing of the year, right? Like there were times in that one where he was like 90, 91. And like he reached back for 94 a few times. But like, yeah, he was probably without it in front of me, I would say he probably averaged like 91 and a half or somewhere in there. And what, it was like six shutout innings. He struck out seven. So yeah, it was a great outing for him.
And I would say with Manoah's second outing and with Gausman's second outing, those were in Kansas City in cold weather. Yeah. You know, like it's not like it was below zero or anything, but it was chilly in Kansas City. And again, executives with other teams or any team will tell you that it's harder. Pitchers will tell you this. It's harder to get fully loose and to get your full velocity on a day that it's that cold.
That's exactly what Kevin Gausman said to me after that outing when I asked him about it. And he was like, yeah, it was kind of chilly out there. And I was like, I know. I was sitting in the camera well. Like, it's cold, man. It was cold in Kansas City. And it was even colder, honestly, in St. Louis on at least one of the days, if not a couple of them. So it's, yeah, some of the early season velocity stuff. Like, yeah, like, yes, it's, you obviously don't want to see it, but there can be some extenuating circumstances and factors that go into that. So I thought you put it well when you said like it means something different for each pitcher. Like it's a very individualized thing from pitcher to pitcher. I don't think there's any reason for like a ton of panic or alarm around anyone with the Blue Jays so far. Like you look at it, like it's kind of funny. Jose Berríos' velocity is fine. His stuff is fine. It's moving, like the velo's there. But if anything, like of the five pitchers in the Blue Jays rotation, he's got to be the one that you're the most worried about going forward.
Yeah, I think the worry is kind of scattered around at this point. Not that there's necessarily
it's well distributed.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that there's deep. Berríos actually, long term, there should be real concern long term with Berríos. I mean, I understand why they made the deal at the time. I understand it, but he signed through 2028. He's making 20 plus million a year. It doesn't look like a good contract. It's just the way it is. So, you know, we'll see what happens. He's still young enough at 28 for that whole perspective outlook to change. The Blue Jays working behind the scenes to make sure it does, you know, so we'll see. At this point, you know, we all know how it looks. And, you know, I think with Berríos, like you say, I mean, the stuff is there. He's sitting kind of 91 to 95 in a given start with his fastball, and, you know, curveball and changeup are in there, but he's someone who's going to see a lot of left-handed batters. We talked about this before, but teams like to stack their lineups with lefties against Berríos, and he's just allowing a lot of hits, a lot of pretty solid contact. So I certainly don't have it all figured out, but, you know, you look at the results, you look at the way he's getting there, and he looks more like a number five starter than a number two starter.
It's so baffling with Berríos, and I'm just reminded of 22, right? Because it was like throughout the season, 15 different times the Blue Jays thought they'd addressed it and thought they'd found what it was, whether it was tipping or it was a mechanical thing, it was lanes, it was usage, it was sequences. And then each time it actually, that didn't end up being the fix. And I just remember like riding those waves throughout the year, like even talking to people and being like, oh, okay, this is what it was. This was the problem and it's good now. And then I did that like 15 times last year. And now I feel like I'm doing it again this year, where it's just like baffling with Berríos sometimes, where he'll carve up Shohei Ohtani, right? Like he'll look amazing with certain sequences to really good hitters, and then it'll be like Luis Renjifo, who he falls behind and leaves a cookie to and gives up a bomb, or like Hunter Renfro will get him on just a really poorly located fastball, like there, you know. And then there will be these weird like pitches off the plate that Bobby Witt Jr. will come up with like a couple hits against. Ohtani had a double off of Berríos on like a slider like down below the zone, like one of those balls that only Ohtani gets to. So he'll give up damage on like those sort of pitcher's pitches, but then also he'll lay, you know, a 92 mile per hour fastball that's not moving a whole ton right into a hitter's happy zone and pay the price for that as well. It just feels like the margin for error is so thin for him. I wouldn't blame him and the Blue Jays if they are looking at like just trying to adjust anything right now, just trying to find that one eureka moment to get him back to a place where, you know, he can get out of these outings that just spiral on him.
Yeah, and there's a lot of time left for him. I think that there's certainly no danger of him losing that rotation spot. I mean, it's obviously his to roll with for years. So, you know, we'll see what they're able to do to get better results. And he is one of their best five options. So we'll see where it goes, really. I certainly don't have the answers for what to expect there.
Nice soft landing spot in his next one with the Tampa Bay Rays coming into town, huh?
That's the challenge, right? And, you know, they don't play the Rays as much. They don't play the Yankees as much. But he's still, you know, certainly coming up this weekend, that's going to be a real test for the Jays. I'm pretty interested to see how that series unfolds. I think it'll be a really good one. Hopefully the Dome's open at some point, maybe for a couple of those day games if the weather stays really nice here in Toronto. But should be a lot of fun. I mean, the Rays are a really, really good team with some great pitching. And certainly the envy of baseball, I think, with the way that they've been able to come up with some pitchers who are, you know, ace caliber, Jeffrey Springs, boom, Drew Rasmussen, like along with McClanahan, along with Glasnow. It is an impressive group.
And it's incredible that like they lose Zach Eflin to the IL, a hit to the rotation, and it's okay, we'll just call up Taj Bradley, one of the best minor league starters, like one of the top prospects in the game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. Very impressive. And then they got some hitters too, with Rosarena and Franco having a great year and Yandy Diaz contributing. So, you know, it's a really good team. It's a balanced team. Certainly way better than the Tigers. The Jays should, watching the Tigers, that opener, the Jays should sweep this series. Like, I know you can't, it's not that simple in baseball. They might lose the next two, but they should sweep this series.
Yeah, two out of three is fine. I think you want to win every series. It's hard to take, like, even the Royals. Royals are not a good team, and the Blue Jays, you know, lost a game to the Royals. It's hard to win a series. Mm-hmm. It really is.
It is.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, I've been like trying to bring this back around to something somewhat positive to end on, so we're not just ending on a dour note. But I think that's fair. Like the weekend series, Blue Jays versus Rays, two really good teams, two good lineups, two teams that if the Blue Jays do sweep the Tigers, as you are 100% predicting that they are definitely going to do, then I imagine the Rays will come in at like 13-0, trying to, you know, make history. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like if the roof's open, good pitching, or at least from the Rays, good pitching. You know, like the balls flying everywhere at the new ballpark. Oh, if we get the roof open, get to see what some of those outfield spaces look like with sun on them. Yeah, man, that'll be a good time. That'll be a great series.
And I'm excited for fans of the Blue Jays who are there in person to see the pace of play in real time, because it's amazing. It's awesome. I mean, in the time that we've taken to record this podcast, you could play seven innings. Honestly, the new rules are so good.
Yeah, you know what? Being on the sidelines I haven't really felt that pace of play when the Blue Jays have been out here playing these like 3.5 hour games. Like, what was it? The finale in LA was over that 3.5 hours.
Yeah, that was.
The Blue Jays have played a couple pretty long ones. But yeah, I do think that like over time, you're going to see a lot more of those kind of 2 hour and 30 minute games, which is just great for the sport.
It's awesome.
All right. That's going to be it for us. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank our producers, Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. We'll talk to you next time on At the Letters.